Chapter 18. Vion buttered a slice of breakfast toast and read the caption on page 2 of his morning newspaper. No leads in terrorist attack on Prime Minister's plane. Boss Gly had covered his tracks well. Vion kept his hand on the investigation, and he knew that with each passing day the scent grew colder. He subtly used the influence of his office to play down any connection between the assassins and the FQS, unless definite proof was found. So far, things were working smoothly. His satisfaction faded to a chill as Vion thought of Gly. The man was nothing but a savage mercenary whose god was a fat price. There was no telling how a mad dog like Gly might run if he wasn't held on a tight leash. Vion's wife came to the doorway of the breakfast room. She was a pretty woman with dark brown hair and blue eyes.
"There's a phone call for you in the study," she said.
He entered the study, closed the door, and picked up the phone.
"This is Vion?"
"Superintendent Macomb, sir," came a voice as deep as a coal pit. "I hope I'm not interrupting your breakfast."
"Not at all," Vion lied. "You're the officer in charge of mounted police records?"
"Yes, sir," Macomb replied. "The file you requested on Max Roubaix is on the desk in front of me. Shall I make a copy and send it to your office?"
"Not necessary," said Vion. "Please give me the basics over the phone."
"It's a bit bulky," Macomb hedged.
"A 5-minute capsule will do." Vion smiled to himself. He could almost imagine Macomb's state of mind. No doubt a family man who was irritated as hell at having to leave a warm bed and a warm wife and a Sunday sleep-in to dig through old, dusty records to satisfy the whim of a cabinet minister.
"The pages are over 100 years old, so they're written in hand script, but I'll do my best. Let's see now. Roubaix's early life is sketchy. No date of birth. Listed as an orphan who drifted from family to family. First official record is age 12. He was up before a local constable for killing chickens."
"You did say chickens."
"Snipped off their heads with wire cutters in wholesale lots. He worked off damages to the farmer whose stock he had decimated. Then he moved to the next town and graduated to horses. Cut the throats of half a herd before he was apprehended."
"A juvenile psychopath with a bloodlust.
People simply wrote him off as the village idiot in those days," said Macomb. "Psychotic motivation was not in their dictionaries. They failed to understand that a boy who slaughtered animals for the hell of it was only one step away from doing the same to humans. Roubaix was sentenced to 2 years in jail for the horse bloodbath, but because of his age, 14, he was allowed to live with the constable, working off his time as a gardener and houseboy. Not long after his release, people in the surrounding countryside began to find the bodies of tramps and drunks who had been strangled."
"Where did all this take place?"
"A radius of 50 miles around the present city of Moose Jaw, Alberta."
"Surely Roubaix was arrested as a prime suspect."
"The Mounties didn't work as fast in the 19th century as we do now," Macomb admitted. "By the time Roubaix was tied to the crimes, he had fled into the virgin forests of the Northwest Territory and didn't turn up again until Riel's Rebellion in 1885.
"The revolt by the descendants of French traders and Indians," said Vion, recalling his history.
"Métis, they were called. Louis Riel was their leader. Roubaix joined Riel's forces and enshrined himself in Canadian legend as our most prolific killer."
"What about the time he was missing?"
6 years, Macomb replied. "Nothing recorded. There was a rash of unsolved killings attributed to him, but no solid evidence or eyewitness accounts. Only a pattern that hinted of the Roubaix touch."
"A pattern?"
"Yes, all the victims were done in by injuries inflicted on the throat," said Macomb. "Mostly from strangulation. Roubaix had turned away from the messy use of a knife. No great fuss was made at the time. People had a different set of moral codes then. They looked upon a scourge who eliminated undesirables as a community benefactor."
"I seem to remember he became a legend by killing a number of Mounties during Riel's rebellion."
13, to be exact."
"Roubaix must have been a very strong man."
"Not really," replied Macomb. "Actually, he was described as frail of build and rather sickly. A doctor who attended him before his execution testified that Roubaix was racked by consumption, what we now call tuberculosis."
How was it possible for such a weakling to overpower men who were trained for physical combat? Asked Vion.
Roubaix used a garrote made from rawhide not much thicker than a wire, a nasty weapon that cut halfway into his victim's throat, caught them unaware, usually when they were asleep. Your reputation is well known in bodybuilding circles, Mr. Vion, but I dare say your own wife could choke you away if she slipped Roubaix's garrote around your neck some night in bed.
You talk as if the garrote still exists.
It does, said Macomb. We have it on display in the criminal section of the Mountie Museum, if you care to view it. Like some other mass killers who cherished a favorite murder weapon, Roubaix lavished loving care on his garrote. The wooden hand grips that attach to the thong are intricately carved in the shape of timber wolves. It's really quite a piece of craftsmanship.
Perhaps I'll have a look at it when my schedule permits, said Vion without enthusiasm. He pondered a moment, trying to make sense out of Sarva's instructions to Danielle in the hospital. It didn't add up. A riddle of ciphers. Vion took a flyer on another tack. If you had to describe Roubaix's case, how would you sum it up in a single sentence?
I'm not sure I know what you're after, said Macomb.
Let me put it another way. What was Max Roubaix?
There was silence for a few moments. Vion could almost hear the gears turn in Macomb's head. Finally, the Mountie said, I guess you could call him a homicidal maniac with a fetish for the stranglehold.
Vion tensed and then relaxed again.
Thank you, Superintendent.
If there is anything else...
No, you've done me a service, and I'm grateful.
Vion slowly replaced the receiver. He looked into space, focusing on the impression of a sickly man twisting a garrote. The stunned expression of incomprehension on the face of the prey. A final glimpse before the bulging eyes turned sightless. Sarva's delirious ravings to Danielle suddenly began to make a shred of sense.